This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Storynomics, story-driven marketing in the post-advertising world. Written and read by Robert McKee and Tom Gerace. Please enjoy the PDF that accompanies this audiobook.
I will hazard a prediction. When you are 80 years old and in a quiet moment of reflection, narrating for only yourself the most personal version of your life story, the telling that will be most compact and meaningful will be the series of choices you have made. In the end, we are our choices. Jeff Bezos, 2010, Princeton Commencement Address. Introduction. The Marketing Crisis. Look around. It's happening. In ever-escalating millions, consumers are cutting the barbed wire of ad-imprisoned media and disappearing into a forest of paid subscriptions and ad blockers. No use searching for these people. They're gone, and they're never coming back. Now, look ahead. Before long, all public and private communication, entertainment, news, music, sports, social media, online searches will be ad-free, leaving sides of buses as the publicity medium of last resort. Millennials, that vital under-40 market, are not only banishing advertising from their lives, but sneering at the institution itself, denouncing its bragging and promising as deceitful, manipulative, the next thing to microaggression. In fact, a recent study revealed that over the past 5 years, television viewing by people under 40 dropped 30%, while ad-free, over-the-top services like Netflix skyrocketed. This massive consumer exit and the resulting drop in ad revenue has tossed umpteen media firms, Tribune Media, 21st Century Media, SBC Media, Relativity Media, Cumulus Media, Next Media, Citadel Broadcasting, The Sun Times, Borders, Blockbuster, Reader's Digest, and dozens more multi-billion dollar corporations into the dumpsters of bankruptcy. In 2015, 76% of marketers surveyed by Adobe claimed that marketing had changed more in the last 2 years than it had in all the decades since the birth of television. Many chief marketing officers swear they will never again trust advertising to deliver customers. Some CMOs condemn ad agencies for wasting time and money trying to be Super Bowl creative instead of market effective. Others blame the noise from free online ads that drowns out their paid ads. Still others complain that falling return on investment, ROI, and rising costs make advertising just too damn expensive. Of course, if advertising suddenly redelivered the mass consumers of decades past, all would be forgiven. The more the push strategies of bragging and promising lose traction, the more marketers turn to the pull tactics of effective storytelling. To support their efforts, the Harvard Business Review has published dozens of articles on the persuasive power of story for both leadership and branding. Umpteen TED Talks have championed the neuroscience behind storyfied messaging, and how-to writers have poured out dozens upon dozens of story and business manuals that could fill a wall at Barnes & Noble. But despite published enthusiasm, boardroom misgivings about the nature and use of story run as wide and deep as ever. Now and then, an inspired campaign uses story to effect. For instance, the What's the Matter with Owen campaign by GE, misunderstood by Apple, or Click Baby Click by Adobe. But overall, corporate storytelling continues to sputter and stumble in confusion, more a trend than a tool. This is true not only for the marketing arms of most companies, but also for the PR and ad agencies that service them. The dream of story-driven commerce is still a dream. With Storynomics, we intend to turn this dream into reality.
Part 1, The Marketing Revolution, investigates the problem. Once the causes of a crisis are exposed, its cure becomes self-evident. Chapter 1, Advertising, a Story of Addiction, asks what went wrong and traces the rise and fall of advertising from Ben Franklin to today. Chapter 2, Marketing, a Story of Deception, traces the problem back beyond advertising to the taproot of marketing logic. Part 2, Story Creation, explores the solution. The next four chapters examine the core elements of story, how they fit the mind, how they move consumer action, and how to design them for effect. Chapter 3, The Evolution of Story, begins with the first human thought and follows the mind's evolution into storied consciousness. Chapter 4, The Definition of Story, lays out the components of the universal, timeless form that underlies all storytelling in all cultures. Chapter 5, The Full Story, delves deeper into the elements of story to help the reader develop her craft. Chapter 6, The Purpose-Told Story, takes the reader through the step-by-step process for designing the ideal marketing story. Part 3, Putting Story to Work, turns solution into action. To transform the way your organization connects to its customers, you must harness your marketing, branding, advertising, and sales to the pooling power of story. The following chapters show you how to storify all four voices. Chapter 7, Story and the CMO, casts the marketer as master storyteller who envisions a campaign and then guides creatives as they transform the concept into storified action. Chapter 8, Storified Branding, demonstrates the use of story to overcome the public's antipathy to corporations and win brand affinity. Chapter 9, Storified Advertising, argues that ads work best when the interruption tells a story that hooks, holds, and entertains. Chapter 10, Storified Demand and Lead Generation, looks at how thinking and planning in story form guides marketing's grand strategy and takes your corporation to long-term success. Chapter 11, Building Audience, explains how brands can integrate into the digital ecosystem to earn and expand audience, allowing the stories they tell to reach the masses. Chapter 12, Storified Sales, lays out the full range of face-to-face storytelling options from point of sale to the viral cascade known as word of mouth. Chapter 13, Nomics, demonstrates how marketers can directly measure the value of their storytelling and compare its efficacy with that of traditional advertising. The conclusion tomorrow looks forward, forecasting the impact of new and upcoming technological change on the use of storytelling in marketing. We examine how the impact of story will continue to grow, and our ability to create immersive experiences will take a leap forward, while essential story form remains the same. Justin Smith, CEO of Bloomberg Media Group, said, "All business is bifurcated into two distinct worlds. The struggling traditional segment that longs for a simpler, more profitable past that will never return, and the vibrant entrepreneurial segment that is reinventing commerce before our eyes." This book was written for you reinventors. We coined the infinitive to storify to name the transformation of data into story form. The adjective storified to describe data that has undergone that change, and the noun storynomics to title the story-centric business practices that drive fiscal results. The difference between data and story is this. Data lists what happened. Story expresses how and why it happened. Data compiles facts by quantity and frequency. Story reveals the causalities behind and beneath those facts. Story eliminates irrelevancies, concentrates on dynamic change, and then reshapes factual subject matter into a structure that links events into chains of cause and effect played out over time. Storynomics taps this enormous potential in the business world. Those marketers who master storytelling techniques will plant and harvest a timeless bounty as they invent the future.
Part 1, The Marketing Revolution. Chapter 1, Advertising, A Story of Addiction. It started innocently enough. In the 1700s, weekly newspapers detailing local life and politics in the American colonies first sprouted everywhere, but then shriveled and died for two reasons. One, printing required a license from the crown that specifically prohibited satire of the king's representatives. A cartoon ridiculing the royal governor may have delighted the paper-buying public, but it bought the cartoonist a ticket to the whipping post. Two, newspaper publishers, who kept their political heads down, struggled nonetheless because paper and ink were costly and revenue depended on subscriptions, a luxury beyond the reach of many. Shrinking subscriber bases drove most papers out of business. To survive, publishers needed a new business model. Advertising was virtually unknown, but each new immigrant ship brought settlers anxious to establish businesses. As they opened shop, craftsmen from coopers to clothiers tried to spread the word. Ads began to appear in the backs of newspapers, providing publishers with a critical new source of revenue. Newspapers that advertised used the new income to lower subscription costs and, with that, sell more papers. Broader reach meant greater influence, which in turn allowed publishers to charge more for advertising. As customers filled their shops, tradesmen bought more ads, papers thrived, and commerce enriched the ever-expanding colonies. Before long, advertising transformed both the publishing industry and the enterprises it served until the two became interdependent. Benjamin Franklin, one of the most successful publishers of the day, leveraged this model with particular deftness. He personally taught business leaders the fine points of print marketing. As the back pages of his Pennsylvania Gazette filled with ads, the paper quickly became Philadelphia's favorite. Building on this financial success, Franklin set up an intercolonial newspaper network from South Carolina to Connecticut, earning him the title Patron Saint of Advertising. Throughout this era, merchants realized that the more prominent the ad, the greater the impact. But standard newspaper practice packed most advertisements cheek by jowl in the back pages with a few between articles. Businesses experimented with size, design, font, and page placement of ads, seeking new ways to impact readers with their messages. In time, they discovered that the most effective advertising strategy was interruption, placing ads directly in readers' way as they read a story. This technique hooks the reader's interest with a news story, then interrupts midstream with a brand message. Sudden intrusion into the reader's flow of thought forces the brand's message into a consumer's consciousness. Publishers, fearful of annoying their subscribers, resisted this tactic at first. But, addicted as they were to ad income, they soon made the practice a newspaper norm, forcing readers to jump from the front page through the ads to finish a story. With hindsight, we now realize that the instincts of those 19th century newsmen were accurate. The more we interrupt consumers, the less we satisfy their overall experience. From the earliest days of advertising, the scent of annoyance has wafted between interrupt ads and interrupted context. Be it news, fiction, or sports, or other live events, audiences simply learned to tolerate it. At the end of the 19th century, rail lines connected cities, allowing manufacturers to reach far beyond the limits of local delivery trucks. Businesses rushed to capture rapidly expanding markets by shifting from local to regional or national campaigns. Ivory Soap was one of the first brands to launch truly nationwide advertising with an initial ad buy of $11,000. By 1897, surging success increased Ivory's ad budget to $300,000 and earned an estimated 20% national market share at its peak. Many other recognized brands quickly followed suit. Newspapers were just the beginning. In the early 20th century, inventor and entrepreneur Guglielmo Marconi hoped to use his patents to control all wireless communication and create a subscription model for radio. But in 1906, an international treaty signed in Berlin decreed that no person, company, or country could monopolize the radio waves. Early broadcasters, therefore, had no choice but to establish the first completely ad-supported media. The graphic can be seen in the PDF. When commercial television began in the 1940s, broadcasting adopted radio's interrupt advertising methods and fast became the dominant form of media consumption. At their height, the three major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, reached a combined 50 million viewers every night during prime time. For 60 years, the television commercial was the primary way Americans learned about new products. The graphic can be seen in the PDF. Television outperformed all other media because it combined mass reach, a rich visual medium for messaging, and guaranteed audience attention. Marketers poured more and more money into television advertising over time, creating increasing demand for ad inventory. And with that spend, ad addiction grew stronger. Media companies could not get enough. They began to cram more advertising into each broadcast hour to drive their revenues and profits higher. In the 1950s, advertising accounted for 4 minutes of viewing time per hour. By the 1970s, commercial time had doubled. But with the growth of cable TV in the 1980s, and then the open internet in the early 1990s, audiences fragmented and advertising rates for individual shows began to fall. Ad-supported networks and cable channels scrambled to protect revenues by shoving still more advertising at an ever-shrinking audience. By 2011, cable networks were running ads for almost 1 minute out of every three. Consumers resist. By 2006, however, new technology stepped in to help consumers skip ads. The video recording device TiVo marketed its 30-second skip feature as a key benefit. Cable providers soon launched video on demand, VOD, so subscribers could bypass ads more easily than ever. A study by the Association of National Advertisers and Forrester Research showed that marketers watched the adoption of these services with nervous pessimism. 70% of advertisers surveyed thought the DVRs and VOD would reduce and destroy the effectiveness of the traditional 30-second ad. In 2006, Advertising Age predicted this. When DVR usage reaches 30 million households in the U.S., expected within 3 years, almost 60% of advertisers say they will spend less on conventional TV advertising. Of those, 24% will cut their TV budgets by at least 25%. Time magazine reported that from 2009 to 2013, the average cost of a 30-second primetime TV commercial dropped 12.5%. When falling ad rates shrank revenues at ad-supported networks, they squeezed even more ads, albeit at a lower cost per ad, into their shows. In February 2015, the Wall Street Journal reported that cable networks were subtly speeding up the action in each broadcast hour to generate more time for ads. The journal quoted one studio executive as saying, "It's gotten completely out of control. Actors' performances are being seriously hurt by running shows this way." To continue to capture ad revenue, media companies experimented with new options, shifting content onto services like YouTube so they could pre-roll the ads that appeared before short videos. At Hulu, they fell back on their old habits, recycling the same tired interrupt ad model that once worked on broadcast television. Either way, marketers could at least guarantee that viewers saw their ads because their media partners prevented fast-forwarding to skip ads. These new capabilities, however, came with a price. By 2013, the cost of targeted online video ads shot past that of television advertising because pre-roll ads on YouTube and interrupt ads on Hulu guaranteed viewership and online delivery, enabling more powerful targeting. The graphic can be viewed in the PDF. In 2016, marketers were projected to spend a record $605 billion on advertising around the world. Digital ad spending surpassed television ad spending for the first time as budgets continued to shift to Facebook and YouTube. And advertising is projected to continue to grow, albeit at a slower pace, in 2017 as media companies, new and old, continue to work to find new ways to interrupt consumers on behalf of brand marketers, all the while denying viewers the best possible experience. But one important thing has changed. Consumers revolt. Although the early internet connected the globe and offered sufficient speed for consumers to browse and read articles, connections were not fast enough for reliable video delivery. Even short YouTube videos needed time to buffer, or they would stall during playback. But by 2005, broadband adoption in the home surpassed dial-up in the United States. With this faster connection came a game changer for consumers. Choice. Consider Netflix, which was originally launched as a DVD subscription service in 1999, competing with Blockbuster and other video rental stores. With broadband adoption now at scale, Netflix launched a fledgling streaming service in 2007, offering consumers the ability to watch a small selection of the Netflix film library on their laptops. 1 year later, the company launched the service on game consoles and set-top boxes that allowed people to watch Netflix easily on their living room TVs. Early Netflix consumers loved having instant access and enjoyed watching their favorite films and later television series completely ad-free. They were happy to pay a simple subscription fee of about $10 per month for unlimited viewing. Netflix invested new subscription revenues to grow its library, steadily adding films and then television shows, which the company licensed from traditional media partners. Subscriber growth soared. In the fourth quarter of 2016, Netflix surpassed 93.8 million subscribers, dwarfing the reach of broadcast and cable networks. The company is expanding at an accelerating rate, adding more than 2 million subscribers each month in countries around the globe. Growing subscriber revenues provides Netflix with a powerful competitive weapon. To expand and retain its subscriber base, Netflix borrowed a modus operandi from HBO and began to invest in original programming. The graphic can be seen in the PDF. Netflix series like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black created rabid fans who spread the word of Netflix online and off. In January 2016, the Wall Street Journal reported, with a $5 billion content budget for this year, Netflix is willing to outbid most any local TV network or streaming service. It seems simple in hindsight. Netflix returned to the same subscription media model that drove early newspapers. But instead of succumbing to the temptation of advertising, which would have put the company's financial incentives at odds with its customers' desires, Netflix kept the two aligned. The company committed to delivering the best entertainment experience possible for its customers, and that meant not interrupting that experience with ads. Their customers responded by shifting their viewing time to Netflix. In February 2017, CNBC reported that Netflix viewers consumed 116 million hours of programming every day, completely ad-free. From a marketer's perspective, that's 116 million hours each day when their customers go dark due to Netflix alone. Netflix inspired an industry. HBO Now and HBO Go, over-the-top services launched by HBO in 2015, drove audience viewership for Game of Thrones alone to over 25 million people in 2016. Spotify had 50 million ad-free subscribers for its premium music service in March 2017, after adding 20 million subscribers in the year prior. Apple signed up 27 million subscribers to its ad-free music service in its first 2 years of operation and was adding more than 1 million subscribers monthly. YouTube introduced an ad-free option in September 2015. Even Netflix rival Hulu, which launched a competitive streaming service 1 year after Netflix, has seen the light. Hulu has created a joint venture among 21st Century Fox, NBC Universal, and Walt Disney Company. Unlike Netflix, Hulu was established to move the traditional network advertising model online. Hulu charged a lower subscription fee than Netflix and showed commercials to users before and during programming. But by June 2015, the market had spoken. Hulu's audience numbered 9 million, just 14% of Netflix's total audience at the time. Hulu announced it was evaluating options. 3 months later, Hulu capitulated and launched an ad-free service for just $2 more per month. The company sent a note to former subscribers, thanking them for showing Hulu the way and inviting them back to Hulu, this time for an ad-free experience. CBS learned a similar lesson. In November 2014, CBS launched All Access, an over-the-top subscription service that included interrupt advertising. In August 2016, the company capitulated to consumer demand and started offering an ad-free version for just $4 more per month. Hitting rock bottom, the decline of traditional media. On January 22, 1996, the New York Times launched on the Internet, providing readers around the world with access to news the night of the publication. Circulation of U.S. newspapers fell 37% from 1990 to 2015 as consumers moved online, with the fastest drop in subscribers coming in 2005. By 2006, marketers recognized the trend. Over the next 4 years, they cut newspaper advertising spending by half, and it has continued to drop every year since. Newspapers have responded by trimming costs, sacrificing much of the content that their subscribers love. The graphic can be viewed in the PDF. Slow connectivity protected broadcasters for a time. Consumers remained captive if they wanted to watch long-form programming. But today, the Netflix phenomenon is taking a heavy toll. Traditional television advertising viewership began a rapid decline in 2010. Television advertising is starting to go the way of the newspaper as marketers adapt to shrinking broadcast audiences. A decline in ad spending, felt precipitously in print in 2007, began to hammer broadcast television in 2015. The graphic can be viewed in the PDF. Banner blindness and blocking. The consumer revolt against advertising is not limited to the adoption of streaming video and music services, however. Since 2008, marketers have been tracking a phenomenon called banner blindness, in which readers of a web page literally look around ads when browsing a page. Eye-tracking studies, which use technology to monitor what part of a web page users actually view, initially identified the phenomenon. A study by Infolinks found that after being asked to recall the last display ad they saw, only 14% of users could name the company, the brand, or the product, suggesting that brands are wasting millions of dollars in ads that consumers don't remember. And then the news for marketers got even worse. In September 2015, PageFair and Adobe announced that 198 million people were using ad-blocking software on their desktop devices globally. The study found that ad-blocking adoption is growing at 41% annually. 1 month later, Apple introduced an iOS software upgrade allowing Apple mobile devices to support ad-blocking as well. The study estimated that $41.4 billion in advertisements would be blocked worldwide in 2016. A new front had opened in the popular revolt against interruption and emotional manipulation. The graphic can be viewed in the PDF. The rapid decline of interrupt advertising created a crisis that hit media companies first. As consumers ignore, block, and pay to avoid advertising, brands have begun to cut advertising budgets. The resulting drop in ad revenues has left media business models upside down. The second phase of the crisis will strike brands in nearly every industry. Marketers, dependent on advertising as the primary way to connect with their customers, are suddenly unable to reach them. Their brands are already starting to fade to dark, but many CMOs have yet to realize it. The marketing crisis. For three centuries, most companies have used the same approach to reach, acquire, and retain customers. They advertised to them. The approach was simple and consistent. Marketers identified the news and entertainment stories that their customers enjoyed most, then interrupted those stories with ads describing their products and services. By showing those ads repeatedly to customers at scale, they built growing brand awareness. If they created ads that connected emotionally with their customers, brand awareness became brand affinity. Today's advertising crisis also created an unprecedented marketing crisis. Advertising has been a tried and true method to reach audiences since Ben Franklin published newspapers. As consumers block, ignore, and pay to avoid advertisements, marketers must scramble to find a new way to reach their customers. Brands that fail to connect will surrender to challenger brands that discover the secret.
Chapter 2. Marketing, a story of deception. Not only do consumers object to interruption, but they hate being played. In the early decades of advertising, word of mouth traveled slowly, allowing snake oil salesmen to make false claims with impunity. Until, that is, customers sickened by their cures horsewhipped them out of town. As the telegraph and then the telephone ricocheted reputations around the country, fake goods gave way to more trustworthy products, and false claims segued into the conventional braggings and promisings that still fill contemporary ads. Today's elixirs promise whiter teeth, thinner waistlines, and fewer wrinkles, with laboratory studies to back them up. In short, marketing became more honest, but not so honest that today's consumers believe whatever they're told. In a world of immediate global information flow, exaggerated underperforming claims backfire. Consumers compare marketing promises with their real-world experience, and when the two don't line up, they mock the brands that played them with scathing product reviews, public tweets, and Facebook posts. Through decades of false promises, marketers have trained consumers to distrust advertising. Don't take our word for it. Since the 1960s, Comscore ARS Group has gauged the efficacy of advertising by measuring its impact on share of choice. Today, its research finds that advertising overall is rapidly losing effect, and when aimed at millennials, it's virtually useless. The two types of marketing deception. Historically, marketers have driven sales through two types of pretense, one rational and the other emotional. This chapter looks at each approach, why it worked in the past, and why it fails today. 1. Rational communication. Classical marketing theory asserts this premise. Human beings are rational decision makers who, when faced with an important choice, gather relevant facts, weigh alternatives, then choose the best option. Therefore, to persuade consumers, present your claims in a factual, logical, scientific manner. That's the theory. In reality, what advertising passes off as logic is in fact rhetoric. Rhetoric imitates science by presenting evidence and drawing a conclusion. But the difference is that science weighs all evidence, both for and against a theorem. Rhetoric slants its argument by laying out only the evidence that supports its claim, while ignoring or refuting every point that contradicts it. In other words, science seeks the truth, rhetoric seeks the win. Marketing, in essence, is a public forum for rhetorical debate, a platform to persuade the consumer that one product's features outperform another's. Ivory's classic ad executes this method to perfection. Procter & Gamble, P&G, offered a laundry soap bar that would float instead of sinking in the tub. Marketers explained the advantage in their ad. It saved time and frustration for people who otherwise would have to search around the bottom of a murky tub when they dropped a competitor's bar. Other soaps may have cleaned better. That is, after all, the purpose of soap. But Ivory, of course, never mentioned that. Do you remember where you learned to use rhetorical persuasion? How to argue using inductive and deductive logic? Writing junior high school essays. Do you remember your seventh grade syllogism lesson? All kings are tall. He is a king. Therefore, he is tall. In the Ivory case, the best soap floats. Our soap floats. Therefore, our soap is best. For example, business-to-business marketers often print up a checklist of product features so the client can compare what's on offer against the competition. With never-failing regularity, the marketer's product scores tops on every feature on the list, whereas the competitor's product leaves blanks. Amazing. As the savvy prospective buyer scans the chart, he knows two things. One, the company self-selected only those categories in which its brand scores best. Two, categories in which the product scored worse than the competition were left off the list. Now more than ever, marketing via rhetorical argument provokes skepticism in the mind of the consumer and a negative attitude toward your product or service. This isn't to say that people distrust all facts, just facts used to persuade a sale. And that distrust directly affects what they are prepared to pay for what's being sold. Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at the Fuqua School of Business and Director of the Center for Advanced Hindsight, demonstrated this skepticism in an experiment with would-be stereo buyers. Ariely compared how two groups of audiophiles responded to a music system. Members of one group read what they thought was an overview by the manufacturer, and the second group read the exact same material, but believed it was by Consumer Reports. He writes, "All of the participants took half an hour to listen to a composition by J.S. Bach and evaluate the stereo system. How powerful was the bass? How clear was the treble? Were the controls easy to use? Were there any sound distortions? And finally, how much would they pay for the system?" As it turned out, the participants liked the stereo much more if they were told that the information they read came from the unbiased Consumer Reports. They also said they would pay, on average, about $407 for the system, far more than the $282 offered by those who read the manufacturer's brochure. Mistrust of marketing rhetoric runs so deep that it colors our perception of products, even in the face of firsthand experience. If the inductive logic of rhetoric delivers sub-optimized marketing results, why do businesses still gravitate toward it? First, education. We were taught to start an essay with an opening thesis. I'm going to prove this. Then point by point, we'd prove it. Finally, we'd write a conclusion, I have proved this. Today, we use that same format at work. A PowerPoint presentation is just a junior high school essay with special effects. Second, the prestige of science. Business leaders strive for scientific planning and choice-making, for predictability and precision, all to the good. But in truth, business is not science. Despite access to massive sets of data, marketing decisions will always call for as much instinct as strategy. The fundamental problems never change. How to capture attention, hold it, and reward it. In short, how to turn people on, not off. 2. Emotional communication. At the heart of an effective creative philosophy is the belief that nothing is so powerful as an insight into human nature. What compulsions drive a man? What instincts dominate his action? Even though his language so often camouflages what really motivates him. Bill Birnbach. Post-World War II America exploded with optimism. Product debuts spiked, TV viewership skyrocketed, and the television ad fast became the most powerful way to influence consumers. But as more and more commercials jammed the airwaves, claims and counterclaims blurred consumer judgment. Which toothpaste actually brightened teeth best? The Doyle Dane Birnbach DDB agency thrived because Bill Birnbach and his partners pioneered a new connection with consumers. DDB steered clients away from rhetorical praise for their product's features. Instead, they set the obvious ethical questions aside and aimed powerful emotional appeals directly at the consumer's subconscious desires and needs. According to one biography, Birnbach spoke to clients not of advertising, but of the art of persuasion. To persuade the consumer, the creators of ads needed to touch people's basic unchanging instincts. Their obsessive drive to survive, to be admired, to succeed, to love, to take care of their own. The first step to mastering emotional manipulation is to realize that there are only two primary emotions, pleasure and pain. Each, however, comes in many varieties. Deeply felt positives such as happiness, peace, love, joy, as well as the sensory delights of beauty and comfort, versus profound negatives of grief, anxiety, dread, fear, loneliness, along with physical miseries that range from toothaches to migraines. In Chapter 6, we'll look at how storified marketing moves a consumer's deep emotions. But for the balance of this chapter, let's focus on the surface of physical feelings. At the sensory level, something either feels good or hurts. An appetizer may delight your taste buds or repulse them. But if experience is only sensory, why do we feel more pleasure when we look at an authentic work of art than a copy? If the sensory perception were the same, why does the thrill we feel standing before Van Gogh's The Starry Night run far deeper than the glum scrutiny of a forgery? As Paul Bloom, professor of psychology and behavioral science at Yale, explains in his book How Pleasure Works, what matters most is not the world as it appears to our senses, rather the enjoyment or suffering we get from something derives from what we think the thing is. Bloom claims that we are essentialists. Our response is conditioned by our beliefs of what things are, what their essential nature is. In 2008, researchers at Caltech studied the link between the price of wine and how much people enjoyed it. Volunteers in the study were offered wines priced at $10, $35, $45, and $90 per bottle. First, they compared the $35 bottle with the $45, then the $10 bottle with the $90 bottle. Participants reported in both cases that the more expensive wines tasted better than the cheaper ones. What's more, the pleasure gap they reported was greater when they compared the $10 and $90 bottles. In actuality, the $10 and $90 bottles contained the exact same wine. Previous researchers had discovered the relationship between high price and the perception of high quality and wrote it off as snobbery. But the Caltech study used an fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging device, to observe the volunteers' brain activity. The imaging revealed that when the participants drank what they believed to be a more expensive wine, the region of the brain linked to pleasure lit up. It wasn't snobbery. They actually enjoyed greater pleasure from the wines they believed were more expensive. The same applies to physical pain. At Harvard University, Kurt Gray and Daniel Wegner administered electric shocks to study participants. The study paired 48 subjects with a partner in a separate room who had the option to either play an audible tone for them or administer an electric shock. Gray and Wegner separated the participants into two groups. In the first, participants were told their partner had chosen to shock them, and moments later, they got a jolt. In the second, participants were told their partner had chosen to play a tone sound, but then, as if by accident, they too received an electric shock. The same voltage was used in both groups. The finding: participants who believed they were shocked intentionally felt the shocks more painfully, and the pain lingered throughout the study. Those who believed the shocks were unintentional experienced less pain and a quicker recovery. For both pleasure and pain, the meaning of the perception, not the sensory experience alone, determines how much pleasure or pain people experience. Because pleasure and pain are great motivators, creating these experiences within an ad promised to be marketing's most powerful tool. Unfortunately, however, this insight devolved into the techniques of seduction and coercion. Seduction entices someone to do something with a promise of pleasure. Coercion persuades them to act with a threat of pain. Consider the ad in the accompanying PDF. As you look at it, does the taste of Bud really matter? Sex sells. Fear also sells. Political ads coerce with the fear of terrorist attacks, fear of losing your job, your healthcare, your income. Home security companies coerce with images of burglars jimmying your windows. Tech companies turn threats of hacks, viruses, and data theft into sales. Emotion-targeted tactics have paid off since Bill Birnbach championed the Mad Men Revolution. So why not stick with tradition? Why not? Because today, these ploys not only fail, they offend. People with money to spend are savvy consumers of media. After exposure to tens of thousands of commercials, they can smell seduction and coercion before the logo hits the screen. That's why nearly two-thirds of millennials use ad-blocking software to cut manipulators out of their lives. What's left? If emotional manipulation angers people, and if rhetorical persuasion strikes them as BS, how can you connect with your customers? How can you solve your marketing crisis? Story. Stories are equipment for living. Kenneth Burke. We advocate a solution that's tens of thousands of years old. The mode of communication that best fits the mind, that best connects one mind with another, that wraps the clarity of a rational message inside an emotional package and delivers it with sticking power. Story. A well-told story captures our attention, holds us in suspense, and pays off with a meaningful emotional experience. Emotional because we sympathize with its characters. Meaningful because the actions of our protagonist deliver insights into human nature. The word itself, story, confuses many marketers. Some, for example, use the words content and story as if they were interchangeable. But as we'll discover, that's like conflating paint in a can with a masterpiece on a wall. Many assume that because they've seen and heard a lifetime of stories, they could easily create one. But that's like thinking you can compose music because you've been to concerts. Many hear the word story and imagine a tale told to children at bedtime or yarns traded over beers at a bar. Those are indeed stories designed simply to entertain. At the other end of the spectrum, great stories have the power to change how humanity sees reality. Storified truths have built civilizations and religions that billions follow. Novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin created political movements that led the way to war. TV series like All in the Family and Will and Grace called out bigotry and paved the way for LGBT justice. And as we'll demonstrate in part 3, thanks to storified marketing, innovative brands can tell stories that change how their consumers view the world and blow past their competition when they do. In short, story is the ultimate IT. I, in that storytelling demands information, a wide and deep knowledge of human nature and its relationship with the social and physical realms. T, in that a well-told story demands skillful execution of its inner technology, its mechanisms of action and reaction, changing value charges, roles, conflicts, turning points, emotional dynamics, and much more. A craft underpins the art. Story structure, as we'll hear in the next chapter, is intrinsic to the human mind. Why then do we need to learn its craft? Isn't storytelling natural? By the same token, children can sketch stick figures. Isn't drawing also natural? Yes, both are. But to achieve excellence, authors and painters move beyond instinct to experiment and master the craft anew. After centuries of struggle, the mathematics of perspective, for example, was finally discovered by Renaissance artists seeking to perfect realism. Art schools have taught this technique ever since, because if we expected young painters to discover the secrets to perspective on their own, it would take their entire careers to achieve what they can learn in a single course. Most, in fact, would never discover it. Similarly, a form shapes story, and a craft executes the telling. If you study story technique, you can learn to hook, hold, and reward your audience's attention, as do the finest of films, plays, and novels. If you refine these skills, you can build bonds of loyalty between your brand and your clients. And finally, if you master storified marketing, as did the likes of Apple, Red Bull, Dove, and GE, your brand will, like theirs, resonate around the world.
Part 2, Story Creation. Story, the evolutionary adaptation to consciousness. Chapter 3, The Evolution of Story. The target of all business strategy is the human mind, that biological engine built by evolution to constantly create and consume stories. Storified communication is not just another selling technique, but the key to capturing, engaging, and rewarding customer attention. As research has repeatedly shown, when marketing storifies its messages, consumers listen. In the age of distraction, attention caught and held is the marketer's single most valuable asset. To bring home story's unique ability to capture and hold audience attention, this chapter traces the evolution of story from day one. What follows is a speculative saga that spans hundreds of thousands of years and blends multiple scientific interpretations of human fossils into a three-act adventure that begins with the birth of consciousness. It builds as the mind battles for survival and climaxes with the triumph of storified thought. Act 1, The First Human Thought. The nervous systems of billions upon billions of creatures evolved into greater and greater complexity over hundreds upon hundreds of millions of years. Then, beginning 2 to 3 million years ago, severe planetary changes forced the central nervous systems of anthropoid bipeds to add brain matter, gray and white, at an average rate of 1 milliliter every 3,000 years. The frontmost portion of the prefrontal cortex, known as Brodmann Area 10, sits just behind the forehead. During human evolution, its 6 cortical layers expanded enormously in both size and reticulation, forcing the skull to grow wide and high. Over time, mutation by mutation, the hominid cerebrum gained 1 full liter of mass and became so tumescent, so structurally complex, its 100 billion cells so interconnected, that the brain, straining to the breaking point, erupted with the first human thought. I am. The silent awareness of me suddenly transformed a brain into a mind, and turn an animal human. Animals react to the objects around them, but the human brain turned itself into an object. Consciousness, in effect, split itself in two. Self-awareness is like a mild schizophrenia. When you look at yourself inside yourself and think the thought, "You idiot," who is angry with whom? When you're pleased with yourself, who pats whose back? When you talk to yourself, who listens? How do these inner transactions work? It goes something like this. Behind your active mind, at the irreducible crux of your humanity, an awareness observes your every thought and deed. This core self is the proprietor, so to speak, of your mind. As if looking through an inner prism, this subjective self splits off a version of itself and then watches this doppelganger think, choose, and act in the world. The core self then judges its outer self, positively or negatively, seeking to change its thoughts and behavior. The core self's observation of itself, strange though it may seem, is both natural and persistent. Tonight, as you dream, you will become a self-aware audience of one, watching yourself perform in your dreams as if you were an actor in an oddly unrealistic film. Awake, you're doing it now. If you were to ask yourself, "Who am I?" a sense of me would rise up from the bedrock of your being. This awareness of me as owner of myself hovers behind your foreground consciousness, observing your waking thoughts, watching you listen to this, and noting how you're doing. Don't bother to turn and look. You cannot face yourself within yourself, but you know that me is always there, always mindful, always watching. When self-awareness invaded the first human mind, it brought with it a sudden sharp sense of isolation. The cost of self-consciousness is a life spent essentially alone, at a distance from all other living things, even your fellow human creatures. With that first primordial I am moment, the mind felt not only alone, but also in terror. For self-awareness brought another, even more frightening discovery, unique to humanity. Time. The first human being suddenly found herself alone and adrift on the river of time. Act 2. The second human thought. In the wake of I am came the second human thought, and someday my time in time will end. Not long after the birth of self-awareness, time awareness flooded the mind, bringing with it dread. Fear is an emotion we feel when we don't know what's going to happen. Dread is the emotion that grips us when we know what's going to happen and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And one dread is certain: our days will stop like an unwound watch. Prior to self-awareness, our Pliocene ancestors, like all animals, lived in the corporeal comfort of a perpetual present. But when the sense of I am separated self-awareness from its primal instincts, visions of a painful future streaked through the newly minted human mind. What's more, the mind discovered that not only is the future in doubt, but the surfaces of people and things cannot be trusted, that nothing is what it seems. What seems is the sensory veneer of what we see, what we hear, what people say, what people do. What is hides beneath what seems. For truth is not what happens, but how and why what happens happens. With neither science nor religion to explain life's unseen causalities, the suddenly self-aware mind must have roiled in confusion as chaos, enigma, meaninglessness, and brevity made life unlivable. The mind had to find a way to make sense out of existence. Act 3, The Story-Making Mind. That's when Story rode to the rescue. Gene by gene, natural selection implanted the mental mechanism